Penrod drove the camels at a pace that not even the hardiest men and beasts could keep up for long. They covered the ground at 8 miles an hour, and kept it up for 18 hours without rest. But it taxed even their endurance to the limit. Both men were also exhausted when he called the first halt. They rested for 4 hours by his pocket watch, but when they tried to rouse the camels to go on, the oldest and weakest refused to come to his feet. Penrod shot him where he lay. They distributed the water that the dead beast was carrying among the other camels, then mounted up and went on at the same pace. When they reached the end of the next 18-hour stage of the march, Penrod calculated that they had roughly another 90 to 100 miles to go to reach the Nile, 10 miles south of Khartoum. Yaqub agreed with this estimate, although his calculations were based on different criteria. They had broken the back of the journey, but it had cost them dear. 36 hours hard going and only 4 hours of rest. When they tried to feed them, the camels refused to eat their meagre ration of durra. Once the 6 camels were couched, Penrod went to each waterskin and lifted it to judge the remaining contents. Then he pondered over the equation of weights and distances and the condition of each beast. He decided on a deliberate gamble. He explained it to Yaqub, who sighed, picked his nose, and lifted the skirts of his galabeah to scratch his crotch, all symptoms of doubt. But in the end he nodded lugubriously, not trusting himself to voice approval. They selected the 2 strongest camels and took them out of sight of the other 4 weaker animals. They watered them from the skins they carried, pouring the sweet water into leather buckets. The animals' thirst seemed unquenchable, and they sucked down bucketful after bucketful. They drank almost 30 gallons each. The change in their condition was startlingly swift. They rested them another hour, then fed them all the rations of durra that their companions had refused. The 2 chosen beasts devoured it gluttonously. Now they were strong and alert again. The resilience of these extraordinary creatures never failed to amaze Penrod. When the 4 hours of rest ended, they led the 2 camels back to where the other 4 lay listlessly. They forced the used-up animals to their feet. Now, when they began the next stage of the journey, the 2 pampered animals carried nothing but their saddles. Between them, the exhausted camels carried all the remaining water and equipment, as well as the 2 riders. 1 collapsed after 3 more grueling hours. Penrod shot it. He and Yaqub drank as much of the water from its skins as their bellies would hold. Then they shared the rest between their 2 strong beasts. They pushed on at the same pace, but within another 10 miles the remaining 2 weaker beasts went down in quick succession. Halfway up the slip face of a low dune, one fell as though shot through the brain, and half an hour later the other groaned and its back legs gave way. It knelt to die, and closed the thick double rows of lashes over its swimming eyes. Penrod stood over it with the Webley in his hand. "Thank you, old girl. I hope your next journey is less arduous." And he put her out of her misery. They allowed the surviving camels to drink what they could of the water, then drank themselves. What remained they loaded up. The 2 camels were strong and willing. Yaqub stood beside them and studied the terrain that lay ahead, the outline of the dunes and the shape of the distant hills.
8 hours to the river, he estimated.
If my backside lasts that long, Penrod lamented as he climbed into the saddle. He ached in every nerve and muscle, and his eyeballs felt raw and abraded by the sand and the glare of sunlight. He abandoned himself to the pacing gait of the beast under him, the legs on each side swinging in unison so that he pitched and rolled in the saddle. The desolate landscape fell away behind them, and the dunes and bare hills were so monotonously similar that at times he had the illusion they were making no progress, but repeating the same journey endlessly. Still clinging to the saddle, he slipped into a dark, leaden sleep. He slid sideways and almost fell off, but Yaqub rode up alongside him and shook him awake. He lifted his head guiltily and looked at the height of the sun. They had been riding for only 2 hours. 6 more to go, he felt light-headed, and knew that at any moment sleep would overtake him again. He slipped to the ground and ran beside his camel's head until the sweat stung his eyes. Then he mounted up again and followed Yaqub through the shimmering wasteland. 2 more he had to dismount and run to keep himself awake. Then he felt the camel under him change its pace. At the same time Yaqub shouted, "They have smelt the river!" Penrod pushed up alongside his camel. "How far?"
An hour, perhaps a little longer, before it will be safe for us to turn eastwards and head straight towards the river.
The hour passed slowly, but the camels paced on steadily until they saw another low ridge of blue shale appear out of the heat haze ahead. To Penrod it seemed identical to hundreds of others they had passed since they had crossed the loop, but Jacob laughed and pointed at it.
"Ha! This place I know!"
He turned his camel's head, and the beast quickened its pace. The sun was halfway towards the western horizon, and their shadows flitted ahead over the barren earth. They came up over the ridge, and Penrod stared ahead eagerly for a glimpse of greenery. The wasteland was unrelieved and unrelenting. Jacob was undismayed. He shook his lank curls in the hot wind as the camels ran on across the plain. Ahead, another low shale bank seemed to rise no more than head high above the level ground. Jacob brandished his goad and leered across at Penrod with a satanic squint.
"Place your trust in Jacob, the master of the sands. Brave Jacob sees the land as a vulture from on high. Wise Jacob knows the secret places and the hidden pathways."
"If he is wrong, brave Jacob will have need of a new neck, for I will break the one on which he balances his thick skull," Penrod called back. Jacob cackled and pushed his mount into a cumbersome gallop. He reached the top of the bank 50 paces ahead of Penrod, stopped, and pointed ahead dramatically. On the horizon they saw a line of palm trees stretched across the landscape, but it was difficult to judge the distance in the flat, uncertain light. The bunches of palm fronds on each long bole reminded Penrod of the ornate hairstyles of the Hadendawa warriors. He estimated that it was under 2 miles to the nearest grove. "Get the camels down," he ordered, and jumped to the ground. Surprisingly, he felt strong and alert. At first sight of the Nile, the weariness of the journey seemed to have left him. They took the camels behind the ridge and couched them out of sight from the river plain. "In which direction lies Khartoum?" Penrod asked. Without hesitation, Jacob pointed to the left.
"You can see the smoke from the cooking fires of Omdurman."
It was so faint on the horizon that Penrod had taken it for dust or river haze, but now he saw that Jacob was right. "So we are at least 5 miles upstream of Khartoum," he observed. They had reached the precise position he had aimed for. He went forward cautiously and squatted on the high ground with the field glasses. He saw at once that he had overestimated the distance to the river bank. It was probably closer to 1 mile than 2. There was no cover on the river plain, which was flat and featureless. It seemed that there was some cultivation under the palm trees, for he made out a line of darker green below the untidy fronds. "Probably durra fields," he muttered, "but no sign of a village." Again he checked the height of the sun. 2 hours until dark. Should we make a run for the river before sunset or wait for darkness? He felt impatience building in him, but he held it in check. While he considered the choice, he kept the binoculars to his eyes. The river bank could be far beyond the first trees of the grove, or it might be right there at the edge. Movement caught his eye, and he concentrated on it. A faint shading of pale dust was rising from among the palms. It was moving from left to right, in the opposite direction of Omdurman. Perhaps it was a caravan, he thought, following the road along the river bank. But then he realized it was moving too fast. Riders, he decided. Camels, or horsemen. Suddenly the dust cloud stopped moving, hung for a few minutes at the same point, then gradually settled. "They have halted in the grove, right between us and the river bank. Whoever they were, they had made the decision for him. Now he had no alternative but to wait for darkness." He went back to where Jacob sat with the camels. "Mounted men on the riverbank. We'll have to wait for darkness when we can sneak past them."
"How many?"
"I'm not certain. A large band. Judging by the dust, there are maybe 20 or so." There was little water left in the skins, no more than a few gallons. With the river in sight, they could afford to be profligate, so they drank their fill. By this time it was slimy with green algae, and had taken on the taste of the crudely tanned leather, but Penrod drank it with relish. What they could not consume they gave to the camels. Then they inflated the empty skins. This was a laborious job. They held each skin between their knees and blew into the nozzle, holding it closed between breaths by clamping a hand over the opening. When each skin was full and tight, they stoppered it. Then they strapped them to the backs of the kneeling camels. All was ready for the river crossing, and Jacob looked at Penrod.
"Jacob the Tireless will keep watch while you rest. I will wake you at the setting of the sun."
Penrod opened his mouth to refuse the offer, then recognized the sense of it. The elation was wearing off, and he realized that without sleep he was nearly at the end of his tether. He knew, too, that Jacob was almost indefatigable. He handed him the field glasses without protest, stretched out on the shady side of his camel, wrapped his scarf round his head, and was almost instantly asleep.
"Effendi!"
Jacob shook him awake. His voice was a hoarse whisper. With a single glance at his face, Penrod knew that there was trouble. Jacob's squint was hideous, one eye fixed on Penrod's face, but the other roved and rolled. As Penrod sat up, his right hand closed on the butt of the Webley.
"What is it?" "Riders! Behind us!"
Jacob pointed back along the way they had come. Far out on the sun-seared plain, a tight bunch of horsemen was coming on fast.
"They are on our tracks!"
Penrod snatched the field glasses from him and stared back at them. They wore the jibba. He counted 9. They were covering the ground at a canter. The leaders were leaning forward in their saddles to watch the ground ahead.
"They were waiting for us," said Jacob. "It was the pigeon that warned them." "Yes, the pigeon."
Penrod leapt to his feet. He took a last glance at the height of the sun. It was squatting wearily on the horizon, and little daylight remained. The camels were ready to run, eager for water, and lunged to their feet at the first touch of the goad. Penrod leapt into the saddle and pointed his mount's head at the distant line of palm trees. He used the goad, and it lumbered into a gallop. From behind he heard the distant thud of a rifle shot, and a bullet ricocheted off the stony ground in a puff of dust and chips, but it was 50 yards out on the left. Even at such long range it was poor shooting, but the dervish favoured the sword and the spear above the gun. They considered any expertise in the use of firearms to be effete and unmanly. The true warrior killed with the blade, man to man. Within seconds the camels had crossed the ridge and were screened by the shale bank from further enemy fire. Penrod knew that they were no match for a good horse over the short run, but he pushed his on with cries of "Ha! Ha!" the sting of the goad and urgent movements of his body. Jacob was lighter, though, and his mount drew gradually ahead. As they raced for the edge of the palm groves, Penrod searched for any sign of the horsemen he had spotted earlier. He hoped they might have ridden on towards Omdurman and left their path open to the river. "Even the best of us needs a little luck," he thought, then heard faint but excited cries from far behind. He looked back under his arm and saw the 9 horsemen sweeping over the shale bank they had just crossed. They were strung out but riding hard. There were more shots, but they flew wide. The palm groves drew closer, and he felt his confidence burgeoning. They had a clear run to the bank of the Nile.
"Come, Effendi, watch Jacob, and you will learn how to ride a camel."
The little Jarlan tribesman laughed with delight at his own sense of humour. Both their animals were extended in full gallop, and Penrod ducked as loose pebbles flew back from the pads of the camel in front of him and flicked past his ears. Suddenly there was a different sound of gunfire, much sharper and clearer. The band of riders he had seen earlier raced out of the grove. They must have been halted and resting among the trees, but now they had been alerted by the shots of the pursuers. All of them wore the jibba of the dervish and were armed with spear, sword, targe, and rifle. They were on a converging course, racing in from the right along the edge of the grove to cut them off from the river. Penrod narrowed his eyes as he judged their speed and the distance to where their paths would cross. "We will make it, but with little to spare," he decided. At that moment, a heavy Boxer Henry .45 caliber bullet struck Jacob's camel in the head and killed it instantly. It dropped onto its nose, and the long legs flew over its head as it tumbled. Jacob was thrown high, then struck the hard ground heavily. Penrod knew that he must be either killed or knocked senseless. He dared not stop to help him. Baring's messages were more important than the life of one man. Nonetheless, he was filled with dismay at the thought of leaving Jacob to the mercy of the dervish. He knew they would give him to their women to play with. The Hadendawa women would castrate a man. then flay every inch of skin from his body without allowing him to lose consciousness, forcing him to endure every exquisite cut of the blade.
"Jakob!"
he bellowed, with little hope of any response. But to his astonishment, Jakob clambered shakily to his feet and looked about groggily.
"Jakob, make ready!"
Penrod leaned out sideways from the saddle. Jakob turned and ran in the same direction to lessen the shock as they came together. They had often practiced this trick in preparation for just such a moment on the battlefield or the hunting ground. Jakob was looking back over his shoulder to judge his moment. As the camel swept by him, he reached up and linked arms with Penrod. He was jerked clean off his feet, but Penrod used the momentum to swing him back over the camel's croup. Jakob grabbed him round the waist and stuck to him like a tick to a dog. The camel ran on without check. The moment Penrod was sure that Jakob was secure, he twisted in the saddle and saw that the closest dervish was only 200 yards out on their right flank. He rode a magnificent cream mare with a flowing golden mane. Although he wore the green turban of an emir, he was not a greybeard but a warrior in his prime, and he rode with the menace of a couched lance, slim, supple, and deadly.
"Abadan Rigi!"
To Penrod's astonishment, the emir challenged him by name.
"Since El Obaid, I have waited for you to return to Sudan."
Then Penrod remembered him. His face and figure were not easily forgotten. This was Osman Atalan, emir of the Beja.
"I thought I had killed you there," Penrod shouted back.
The emir had chased him as he had carried the wounded Adams out of the broken square, just as the dervish charge overwhelmed it. Osman had been riding another mount, not that lovely mare. Penrod had been up on a big, strong gelding. Even burdened with Adams, it had taken Osman a good half mile to catch him. Then they rode stirrup to stirrup, shoulder to shoulder, as though riding each other off the ball in a game of polo. Osman slashing and hacking with that great silver blade, and Penrod meeting it with parries and stop hits until his moment came. Then he feigned, a straight thrust at Osman's eyes. The dervish threw up his targe to catch the point, and Penrod dropped his aim and hit him, driving hard under the bottom rim of the targe. He had felt his steel go well in. Osman reeled back in the saddle, and his mount had swerved aside, breaking out of the trial of strength. Looking back under his arm as he carried Adams away, Penrod had seen that Osman's mount had slowed to a walk, and that his rider was hunched over and swaying. He had thought he was probably mortally wounded. But that was clearly not the case, for now Osman shouted,
"I swear on my love of the Prophet that today I will give you another chance to kill me."
Osman's men rode close behind him, and Penrod saw that they were as dangerous as a pack of wolves. One of the Agadjiers aimed his carbine and fired. The black powder smoke erupted from the muzzle, and the bullet parted the air so close to Penrod's cheek that he felt its kiss. He ducked instinctively and heard Osman shout behind him,
"No guns! Blades only! I want this one for my sword, for he has tainted my honour."
Penrod faced ahead, giving all his concentration to wringing the utmost from the camel under him. They rushed towards the palm grove, but behind him he could hear the thunder of hooves riding to a crescendo. As they rode past the first trees of the grove, he saw that he had been mistaken. This was not a field of durra, but a dense stand of second-growth palmetto. The long needle spines could stab through the hide of a horse, but not that of a camel. He turned his mount's head, and it charged straight at the thicket. He heard the hoofs closer behind him, and the hoarse breathing of a horse at full gallop, then saw the mare's golden head appear in the periphery of his vision.
"Now is your chance, Abadan Rigi,"
Osman called, and pushed the mare alongside the camel. Penrod leant across the narrow gap and thrust at his turbaned head, but Osman swayed back and kept his targe low, sneering at Penrod over the rim.
"The fox never comes twice to the snare," he said.
"You learn swiftly," Penrod conceded, and caught the great crusader sword on his own slim blade, turning it in the air so that it flew past his head. He steered the camel with his toes against its neck into the thicket of spiny palmetto. The camel crashed through, but Osman turned aside, breaking off his attack rather than lame or cripple the mare. He galloped furiously around the edge of the thicket, while the camel ran straight through. He had lost at least 100 paces as he came back into the camel's tracks and rode hard to catch up with it again. Penrod saw the wide expanse of the Nile directly ahead, a shimmering luminescence in the fading light. The camel bounded forward under him as it, too, saw the river. Penrod carried the sabre in his right hand, with the goad and the reins in the left.
"Jacob, take my pistol," he said.
"And for the love and mercy of Allah, try this time to aim fair and shoot straight." Jacob reached round his body and pulled the Webley from his sash.
"The remarkable Jacob will slay this false emir with a single shot," he cried,
took deliberate aim, and closed both eyes before he fired. Osman Atalan did not flinch at the crack of the shot. He came on swiftly, but he had seen how close they were to the river bank. He swung the mare in across the camel's rump and stood in the stirrups with the long sword poised. Penrod saw that he had changed his attack, and that he meant to cripple the camel with a deep cut through the hamstrings. With a stab of the goad and a hard tug on the reins, he swung the beast's shoulder into the mare. Standing off balance in his stirrups, Osman could not respond swiftly enough to counter the turn, and the two animals came together with the impetus of their combined weights. The camel was almost twice the height of the mare at the shoulder, and half again as heavy. She reeled and went down on her front knees. Osman was thrown onto her neck. With the skill and balance of an acrobat, he retained his seat and kept a grip on his sword. However, by the time the mare had found her feet again, the camel had pulled too far ahead for her to catch up before it reached the riverbank. As he raced towards it, Penrod had only a moment to survey the river before him. He saw that the bank was a sheer drop of 10 feet, and that the water below it was green and deep. It was at least a mile across to the opposite bank, and three large islands of reeds and papyrus were floating down in stately procession towards Khartoum in the north. That was all he had time to observe. With Osman and his agadjiers racing up behind them, he urged the camel straight to the top of the bank.
"In God's name!" shrieked Jacob. "I cannot swim!"
"If you stay here, the dervish women will have your balls," Penrod reminded him.
"I can swim,"
Jacob changed his mind.
"Sensible Jacob,"
Penrod grunted, and as the camel hesitated, he stabbed hard into its neck with the goad. It leapt outwards so violently that Jacob lost his grip on the Webley as he snatched at a handhold. With a gut-wrenching sensation, they dropped to hit the water with a splash as high as the bank above their heads. The agadjis reined in their horses and milled about on top of the bank, firing down at the two men floundering on the surface.
"Stop!"
Osman shouted angrily, and knocked up the barrel of Al-Nur's carbine. His intervention came too late, for a bullet fired by one of the others hit the camel and damaged its spine. The terrified beast swam desperately with its front feet, but its paralyzed back legs anchored it so that it turned in small circles, bellowing and hissing with terror. Despite the crippling injury, it rode high in the water, buoyed by the inflated waterskins.
"You think you have cheated me yet again?"
Osman shouted across the water.
"But I am Osman Atalan, and your life belongs to me."
Penrod guessed immediately from the emir's tone of false bravado that, like most desert Arabs, he could not swim. For all his wild courage on land, he would never expose himself and his beautiful mare to the attack of the jinn and the monstrous Nile crocodiles that infested these waters. He would not follow his enemy over the bank into the swift green river. For a minute longer, Osman wrestled with his chivalrous instincts, his passionate desire for single combat to avenge himself on his enemy with the sword. Then he gave way to expediency and made an abrupt, eloquent chopping gesture with his right hand.
"Kill them,"
he ordered. At once his agadjiers jumped to the ground and lined the top of the bank. They aimed volley after volley at the group of bobbing heads. Penrod seized Jacob by one arm and dragged him behind the struggling camel, using it as a shield. The current carried them swiftly downstream, and the agadjiers followed, running along the bank and keeping up a hail of carbine fire. All the time the current was carrying them away from the bank, and the range was opening. At last a lucky shot struck the camel in the head, and it rolled over like a log in the water. Penrod drew the dagger from his sash, and cut loose one of the inflated skins from its saddle.
"Hold here, brave Jakob," he gasped,
and the terrified Arab seized the bag of rawhide rope. They abandoned the camel's carcass, and Penrod swam them slowly out across the current towards the middle of the river. As darkness dropped over them, with the suddenness of the African night, the shape of the dervish on the bank faded away, and only the muzzle flashes of their rifles still showed. Penrod swam with a gentle sidestroke, kicking with both legs, paddling with one hand and towing Jakob with the other by the scruff of his neck. Jakob was clinging to the skin bladder and shivering like a half-drowned puppy.
"There are crocodiles in this cursed river so large they could swallow a buffalo, horns and all."
His teeth chattered, and he choked on a mouthful of water. "Then they would not trouble themselves with a skinny little jarlin," Penrod comforted him. A huge dark shape loomed out of the gloom and bore down on them. It was one of the floating islands of papyrus and reeds. He caught a handful of reeds as it drifted by and dragged himself and Jakob up onto it. The vegetation was so densely matted and intertwined it could have supported a herd of elephants. It undulated softly under their feet as they crawled across it to the side nearest Khartoum. They squatted there, regaining their strength and gazing across at the eastern bank. Penrod was worried that on such a moonless night he might not see the city when they reached it, and stared into the darkness until his eyes ached. Suddenly he thought he could make out the ugly square shape of Mukran Fort, but his eyes were playing tricks, and when he stared at it, it dissolved. "After such a journey it would be the height of stupidity to sail past Khartoum in the night," he muttered, and then his doubts were dispelled. From downstream there came the crash of artillery fire. He leapt to his feet and peered through the papyrus stems. He saw the brilliant orange muzzle flashes of cannon demarcating the Omdurman side of the river. Seconds later, the shells burst on the east bank and illuminated Khartoum's waterfront. This time there was no mistaking the stark outline of Mukran Fort, and beyond it the consular palace. He smiled grimly as he remembered the nightly artillery bombardment by the dervish gunner whom David Benbrook had dubbed the Bedlam Bedouin. "At least he's not run out of ammunition yet," he said, and explained to Jakob what they had to do.
"We are safe here," Jakob demurred. "If we stay here, the river will push us in time to the bank, and we can walk ashore like men, not swim like iguanas."
"That will not happen until you reach the Shabluka Gorge, where this raft will surely be destroyed. You know well that the gorge is the lair of all the most evil river genii." Jakob thought about that for a few minutes, then announced,
"Brave Jakob fears no genie, but he will swim with you to the city to watch over you."
The skin bladder had leaked half its air, and they blew it tight again while they waited for the raft to reach the most advantageous point. By then the moon had risen, and although the dervish bombardment had petered out, they could make out the city's skyline clearly, and even see a few small cooking fires. They slipped into the water. Jakob was becoming more courageous by the minute, and Penrod showed him how to kick with his legs and helped drive the bladder across the current. After a laborious swim, Penrod felt the bottom under his feet. He let the bladder go and dragged Jakob ashore.
"Fearless Jakob defies all the crocodiles and gin of this little stream."
Jakob posed boldly on the bank and made an obscene gesture towards the Nile. "Jakob should close his fearless mouth," Penrod advised, "before one of the Egyptian sentries puts a bullet in his defiant backside." He wanted to get into the city secretly. Apart from the danger of being shot by the guards, any contact with the troops would result in him being taken immediately to General Gordon. His orders from Sir Evelyn Baring were to deliver his message to Benbrook first, and only then to report to Gordon. Penrod had spent months in Khartoum before and after the disaster of El Obeid, so he was intimately aware of the layout of the defences and fortifications which were concentrated along the riverfront. Keeping well outside the walls and the canal, he worked his way swiftly around the southern outskirts. When he was almost opposite the domed roof of the French consulate, he approached the canal bank. Once he was certain that it was clear, they waded across, the water only chin-deep. When they reached the other side, they lay up in the palm grove to wait for the patrol to pass. Penrod whiffed the smoke of Turkish tobacco before he saw them. They sauntered past along the footpath, rifles trailing, the sergeant smoking. It was behaviour typical of the slovenly Egyptian troops. As soon as they were gone, he dropped into the drainage ditch that led to the outer city wall. The ooze stank of raw sewage, but they crawled through the tunnel, past the back wall of the French consulate and into the old town. Penrod was perturbed at how easily they had got through. Gordon's defences must be stretched to breaking point. At the beginning of the siege, he had commanded 7,000 Egyptians, but that number must have been much reduced by the attrition of disease and desertion. They hurried through the deserted alleys, stepping round the bloated carcasses of men and animals. Even the appetite of the crows and vultures was inadequate to the task of devouring such an abundance. The stench of a city under siege assailed his nostrils, death and putrefaction. He had heard it called the cholera bouquet. Penrod paused to pull his pocket watch from its pouch and held it to his ear. It had not survived the dousing in the river. He looked at the moon, judged that it was well after midnight, and hurried on unchallenged through the deserted streets. When they reached the gates of the consular palace, there was still lamplight in a few windows. The sentry at the front gate was asleep, curled like a dog in his box. His rifle was propped against the wall, and Penrod took charge of it before he kicked him awake. It took some time and a great deal of argument with the sergeant of the guard, but despite his appearance and the smell of sewage that wafted from his robes, Penrod was able at last to convince him that he was a British officer. When he was led to David Benbrook's office, the consul was reading by lamplight. He looked annoyed by the intrusion, as he removed the reading glasses from his nose and stood up. He was dressed in a velvet smoking jacket, and had been poring over a sheaf of documents. "What is it?" he snapped. "Good evening, Consul," Penrod saluted him. "I'm sorry to trouble you at this time of night, but I've just arrived from Cairo with messages from Sir Evelyn Baring." "God bless my soul!" David stared at Penrod in amazement. "You're English?" "I am, sir. I have had the pleasure of your previous acquaintance. I am Captain Ballantyne of the 10th Hussars."
"Ballantyne! I remember you well. As a matter of fact, we were speaking about you just the other day. How do you do, my dear fellow?"
After they had shaken hands, David held his handkerchief to his nose.
"First thing is to get you a bath and some fresh clothes."
He rang for the servants.
"I'm not sure that there'll be hot water at this time of night," he apologized, "but it shouldn't take long to get the boiler going."
Not only was the bath water scalding, David Benbrook even produced half a cake of perfumed soap from Paris and lent Penrod a razor. While he shaved, David sat on the lid of the commode across the tiled bathroom. He seemed oblivious to Penrod's nudity and scribbled notes in a little red leather-bound book. As Penrod repeated Baring's long and involved message, then he questioned Penrod avidly about General Stuart's preparations for the rescue expedition.
"Hasn't even left Wadi Alfa yet?" he exclaimed with alarm. "By gad, I hope we'll be able to hold out until he gets here."
David was of almost the same build as Penrod. Even a pair of his boots fitted as though they were made for the younger man. Penrod had considerably less girth, but he belted in the trousers and tucked in a freshly ironed white shirt. When he was dressed, David led him back to his study. "I cannot even offer you a brandy to wash it down," he said, as a servant placed a beautiful Sèvres plate before Penrod. On it sat a small portion of durra cake and a lump of goat's milk cheese, no larger than the first joint of his thumb.
"Hard commons, I'm afraid."
"Very nourishing, sir," Penrod nibbled the durra.
"Damn pleased to have your dispatches, Ballantyne. We've been completely in the dark here for months. How long did it take you from Cairo?"
"I left here on the 19th of last month, sir."
"Damn me, but that was good going," David nodded.
"Now tell me what the London newspapers are saying." He was eager for every scrap of news that Penrod could tell him. "They're quite openly reporting the bad blood between General Gordon and Mr. Gladstone, sir. And public opinion is strongly on General Gordon's side. They want Khartoum relieved, the general rescued, and the savages taught to mind their manners."
"What is your opinion, Captain?"
"As a serving officer, I do not allow myself an opinion on such matters, sir."
"Very wise," David smiled. "But as a member of the public, do you think that the Prime Minister has shown lack of resolve?"
Penrod hesitated.
"May I speak frankly, sir?" That is what I am inviting you to do. Whatever you say will remain between us. You have my word on it. I think that Mr. Gladstone has shown neither cowardice nor indecision in refusing to send an army upriver to save the life of General Gordon, as most of the British public believes. The General had only to embark on one of his steamers and come home. I believe that the Prime Minister did not feel justified in involving the nation in costly and risky operations here in the heart of Sudan, merely to vindicate the personal honour of one man. David drew a deep breath.
My goodness me, I asked for your frank opinion, and I certainly got it. But tell me, Ballantyne, don't you think that there's not some personal resentment in Whitehall for an officer whose rash and intractable actions have brought so much odium upon him?
It would be remarkable if that was not the case. It is clearly demonstrated in the dispatches from Sir Evelyn that I delivered to you. David considered Penrod seriously. He was not just a pretty fellow, he thought. He had a thinking head on his shoulders.
So you would oppose the dispatch of Wolseley's force to our relief?
Oh, no, never, Penrod laughed. I'm a soldier, and soldiers thrive on war. I hope to be in the thick of it, even if it doesn't make good sense, which is apparent, and if matters turn nasty, which is highly likely. David laughed with him. War seldom makes good sense, he agreed.
It is refreshing to hear a military man say it, but why has Gladstone changed his mind and agreed to send an army?
The express desire of the nation is a force to which Mr. Gladstone has always acceded. I understand from Sir Evelyn Baring that the Prime Minister was advised that only a single brigade would be needed for the expedition. Only after he had reluctantly taken the decision and announced it to the nation did the War Ministry ask for a much larger force. It was too late then to reverse the decision, so the relieving army has become not a single brigade, but 10,000 men. The hours sped away as they talked until the grandfather clock in the corner chimed again. David stared at it in astonishment.
2 o'clock, upon my soul!
We'll have to give you a few hours' sleep before you meet Gordon. I imagine you're in for a torrid time with him. The servants were waiting up for him, but David dismissed them and personally showed Penrod to one of the guest suites. The night was so sultry, and he was so tired that he could not bother himself to don the thick flannel nightshirt that David provided. Instead, he stripped naked, and before he crawled beneath the single sheet, he placed his dagger under the pillow. Then he went out like a candle in a high wind. He awoke without a change in his breathing, and was immediately aware that someone was in the bedroom with him. While he feigned sleep, he tried to remember where he was. Through his eyelashes he saw that the curtains were drawn, and the light in the room was muted. It was still early in the morning. He moved his hand infinitesimally slowly under the pillow until his fingers curled around the hilt of his dagger. He waited like a coiled adder for the strike. There was a light footstep beside his bed, and someone coughed softly, nervously. The small sound gave him direction, and he launched himself off the bed. He bore the intruder to the floor, held him by the throat with one hand, and with the other touched him with the point of the dagger.
"If you move, I will kill you,"
he whispered ferociously in Arabic.
"Who are you?"
Then he became aware that his captive smelt of rosebuds, and the throat he held was silken smooth and warm. The body under him was clad in taffeta bodice and skirts, and there were marvellous protuberances and hollows under the fine cloth. He released his hold and sprang to his feet. He stared down in astonishment and consternation as his captive sat up. It took him some seconds to grasp that he had assaulted and threatened a young woman with shining blonde hair, and that sitting on the floor with her skirts in disarray around her, her eyes were at the same level as his naked groin. Her gaze was fixed upon an object that happened to be a part of his anatomy seldom exposed to public scrutiny. Still gripping the dagger, he spun round to grab the sheet from the bed. Before he could wrap it round himself, he realized that he was offering the reverse view to the young woman. Haste made him clumsy, and he fumbled until at last, modestly covered, he faced her again.
"I am mortified, Miss Benbrook. I had no idea it was you. You startled me."
Her pale cheeks were slowly suffused with a rosy blush, but she was still panting for breath, as though she had run a distance. The effect this had on what lay beneath her bodice was riveting.
"If I startled you, sir, then you have no idea how you have alarmed me. Who are you, and what are you
Her hand flew to her mouth, as she recognized him, despite his unflattering new haircut.
"Captain Ballantyne!"
"Your servant, madam." His bow was spoilt by the need to retain a grip on both the dagger and his sheet. She scrambled to her feet, stared at him a moment longer with wide eyes, then fled from the room. He stared after her. He had forgotten how pleasing she was to the eye, a condition not at all spoilt by her confusion and dismay. Then he grinned.
"That alone was worth the journey," he said to himself.
He whistled as he shaved and dressed, then winked at himself in the mirror and said aloud, "Perhaps next time she'll recognize me more readily, now that she has more to remember me by." Then he went down the stairs. David was already seated at the breakfast table, but apart from the white-robed servants, he was alone. "Have some of this." He placed a spoonful of an amorphous pale green substance on Penrod's plate. "The taste is execrable, but I have it on excellent authority that it is highly nutritious." Penrod peered at it suspiciously. It looked like green cheese. "What is it?" "I understand that it is the curds of papyrus and reed weeds, made by my daughters. We eat a lot of it. In fact, since the official rations were reduced to one cup of durra corn a day, we eat little else." Penrod put a morsel cautiously into his mouth. "My compliments to your daughters. It is very palatable," he tried to sound convincing. "It's not bad, really. Try it with Worcester sauce or gentleman's relish. You'll soon grow accustomed to it. Now, shall we go and call upon General Gordon?"